White House at Washington, the flag flies at half staff as a grief-stricken nation mourns the death of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, President of the United States. Inside in the historic cabinet room, Vice President Harry S. Truman takes the oath of office as 32nd President, administered by Chief Justice Harlan Fiske Stone.
All right, it's Dave Plyer for Steve Cochran here on 720 WGN. Happy July 4th to all of you. The strength and prestige of the American presidency has waxed and waned since George Washington. There's a new book out called Accidental Presidents, Eight Men Who Changed America, which looks at eight men who came to the office without being elected to it. It demonstrates how the character of the man in that powerful seat affects the nation and the world. Eight men have succeeded to the presidency when the incumbent died in office. Joining us to talk about it all is author Jared Cohen, who is also the founder and CEO of Jigsaw at Alphabet Inc., one of the largest companies in the world. He also serves as an adjunct senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, and he joins us this morning. Good morning, Jared.
Good morning. Thank you.
Do we focus too much on the president these days and not enough about who the vice president is? Because this book is more about vice presidents than it is presidents.
So what's interesting about the vice presidency is we treat it as this irrelevant, you know, office or an office that's kind of an afterthought. But if we reflect back on our history, on eight different occasions, you've had the vice president become president upon the death of their predecessor. And between 1841, which is the first time it happened, and 1963, which is the last time it happened, the president died in office every 10 to 20 years. And that doesn't even take into account the 19 times that the president almost died. So, you know, we've basically winged presidential succession through our history, but eight different times a man who wasn't the voter's choice, who was ostracized from the administration, who did not enjoy a good relationship with their predecessor, is thrust into the pinnacle of power at some of the most seminal moments in the history of our republic, right? The hot debates around slavery, the dawn of Reconstruction, World War II, and the height of the Cold War.
And you know, what's really amazing to me is even back then in the 1800s, it was kind of a, it was kind of a token to be a vice president. Like, you did something, we're going to put you up, we're going to put you on the ticket, congratulations. But they really didn't think about the importance of this role in case something didn't happen or did happen to the president.
That's right. As I discuss in the book, the founding fathers didn't really want a vice president in the first place. They ultimately added a vice president at the last minute as an electoral mechanism, as the office that would be given to the person that got the second largest number of votes. And that was later changed with the 12th Amendment. But the Constitution does not say that the vice president becomes president. What the Constitution says is that the vice president discharges the duties of the president and the vice president when the president dies, but it doesn't say that they assume the office. So when William Henry Harrison dies after just 30 days in office in 1841, John Tyler, who was an afterthought thrown onto the ticket as the second part of the catchy phrase Tippecanoe and Tyler II, you know, skipped town to Virginia to spend 4 years of irrelevance as vice president. John Tyler reads the Constitution and takes a minority view that the language suggests that he is the president. So he races back from his home in Virginia through a combination of horse-drawn carriage, steamboat, and rail, and prepares to fight with the cabinet and to fight with Congress, neither of who think he's the president. So, he wins the battle and sets a precedent in 1841 that as recently as 1963 holds. So Lyndon Johnson becomes president in 1963 based on a precedent set by John Tyler in 1841. And that precedent isn't formalized until you have a 25th Amendment passed in 1967.
Now, Tyler opposed much of what President Harrison stood for, as we know, not to mention the Whig Party in general. So, again, now we have a man that gets into office that doesn't reflect the individual that he replaces. So when their mission,
which you would think would make people not want to sustain the precedent that he set, right? Because ultimately John Tyler, so he ascends to the presidency when Harrison dies, and he fights with the Whig Party, and they end up excommunicating him from the party. So to this day, he's the only president to be formally kicked out of his own party. So his obsession with covertly annexing Texas, which precipitates war with Mexico, is entirely about finding some kind of electoral path for himself as a third-party candidate in the election of 1844. But when Zachary Taylor dies in 1850 after just a year in office, and Millard Fillmore takes over, there's no question about whether Fillmore is president. So even though John Tyler was an utter disaster, and even though he later, dies a traitor to the Union, the precedent holds in 1850, and it's a testament to how important precedent is that Millard Fillmore, Andrew Johnson, Theodore Roosevelt, Calvin Coolidge, Harry Truman, and Lyndon Johnson all became president based on that same precedent.
John Tyler was also the first president to marry in the White House, and I find this ridiculously fascinating that nearly 175 years later, two of his grandchildren, not great-grandchildren, not great-great-grandchildren, two of his grandchildren are still living today.
That's correct. It's one of the great genetic stories. So John Tyler fathers his last child in his 70s, and he had 15 children. So he fathers the last one in his 70s, and then that child had two kids who are today in their mid and late 90s. So what's interesting about having two grandsons who are still alive, of a president who was born during the administration of George Washington, is one, they kind of look like him. And then two, they have incredible oral histories that they've passed down. So what we forget is that until you had the 25th Amendment in 1967, there was no provision for replacing the vice president. And six of the eight presidents who became president when their predecessor died nearly themselves died in office. The first was John Tyler. So February 28th, 1844, John Tyler is sailing on board the USS Princeton, which is a state-of-the-art nautical wonder, in celebration of American naval prowess and the fact that he was on the verge of annexing Texas. And as they go by Mount Vernon, someone suggests that they fire the Peacemaker, which is this state-of-the-art long gun in tribute to the great George Washington. The gun explodes. It kills the Secretary of State. It kills the Secretary of Navy. It kills John Tyler's favorite slave. It kills multiple ministers, senators, and senior officials. More senior U.S. officials die in that explosion than any other moment in U.S. history, and it would have killed our nation's first accidental president, but he was down below deck flirting with a girl who was more interested in the captain's son. They go above deck together to see what the explosion was. She sees her dead father on the floor, who's a New York State senator. She faints into the president's arms. He carries her down the gangplank. She's startled at that moment, nearly knocks them both overboard when she realizes she doesn't know who's carrying them, and then she ends up kind of falling in love with him because she misses her father and becomes the youngest first lady in the history of the United States after a secret wedding in New York that takes place in Gramercy Park.
So just three generations, President Tyler, his son Lyon Tyler, and grandson Harrison span almost the entire history of the United States.
That's correct.
That's amazing. Absolutely amazing. Millard Fillmore succeeded the esteemed General Zachary Taylor. Tell us a little bit about Millard.
So what you need to know about Millard Fillmore is, like John Tyler, he did not enjoy a good relationship with his predecessor. He was completely estranged from the administration, but Millard Fillmore does something that no other accidental president does, which is he takes the oath of office and then immediately sacks the entire cabinet. So when we think about musical chairs and cabinet vacancies today, it's nothing compared to what happened in 1850, because Congress then goes into recess and leaves left without any cabinet chiefs for many months. Now, 1850 is also literally the most polarized moment in the history of the Republic. It's when the sort of the most important debates about slavery are taking place. And these are the debates around what to do with all the territory that was ceded to the Union following war with Mexico. And the decisions that are made around that territory will determine whether or not the Civil War likely happens or not. So this was an incredibly important moment. It's also, what I write about in the book is some of just these colorful anecdotes, like a senator from Mississippi pulling a gun on another senator in the chamber and trying to shoot him and having to be restrained. It has choking, punching, all of the hallmarks of a sort of fraternity party brawl, except right there in Congress. And what's amazing is when it's all done, they just get back to work.
Well, we are talking to Jared Cohen, CEO of Jigsaw at Google parent company Alphabet. He's got a new book out called Accidental Presidents, Eight Men Who Changed America.
At 2:38 in the forward cabin of Air Force One, a necessary ceremony.
I do solemnly swear that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States.
Reserve the Constitution of the United States.
We're talking to Jared Cohen. His new book is Accidental Presidents, Eight Men Who Changed America. Andrew Johnson obviously succeeded our greatest president of the United States. Tell us a little bit about Andrew and his time in office.
Andrew Johnson had the worst debut of any vice president in the history of the Republic. He, when he delivers his inaugural address as vice president, it's supposed to be a 30-second, you know, quick wham bam and swearing on the Bible. It's a 17-minute drunken tirade in which he points to every member of the cabinet and insults them. He can't remember the name of the Secretary of the Navy and has to stop to ask. He then puts his hand on the Bible 17 minutes later and slobbers all over it. He tells a Senate clerk he's too drunk to swear in the new members of the Senate, so asked the clerk to do it, which I'm not sure is constitutional. And then Lincoln, you know, walks side by side with him outside to kind of ease the tension just before he delivers arguably the greatest address of his career, his second inaugural, and points out Frederick Douglass, who observes that this is a man who we should thank the heavens is not president. And he looks into his eyes and says, this is also a man who's no friend of my race. So this is on March 4th, 1865. April 14th, 1865, Lincoln is assassinated. Andrew Johnson had skipped town to go into sort of shameful hiding after this drunken tirade. And the first time he sees the cabinet again is at Lincoln's deathbed. And they all know that he's about to become president. And yet one of the members of the cabinet asks him to leave because he's making Mary Todd Lincoln uncomfortable. Now, I want to say that we winged presidential succession and we more or less got lucky, but that would neglect the reality that we were supposed to get Abraham Lincoln's vision for Reconstruction. And instead, we got Andrew Johnson, you know, not just a man who drunkenly delivered his inaugural address, but a man who was born a racist, died a racist, last president to own slaves, a man who didn't emancipate his own slaves until 7 months after the Emancipation Proclamation, and who resurrected almost every old vestige of the Confederacy, delegating civil rights to the states, giving amnesty to all the traitors, paving the way for the Black Codes, which paved the way for the Jim Crow laws, which gave us 100 plus years of segregation.
Chester Arthur was probably the most hated of successors to the presidency, actually had to defend himself as if he was in the plot to assassinate James Garfield.
That's right. Chester Arthur was probably the most loathsome of all of the vice presidents, just in the fact that he subverted his own administration. He was an embodiment of the spoil system and cared about nothing beyond patronage. And so when James Garfield unexpectedly gets the nomination in 1880, it really sort of sends the Ulysses S. Grant machine apparatus into a tailspin. And that's the apparatus that Arthur is part of, because it potentially cuts them off from all of this patronage. And so the literally on the eve of Garfield's inauguration, Chester Arthur and another New York party boss named Roscoe Conkling barge into his room in the middle of the night and start lecturing him on patronage. It was literally right before he's about to wake up and deliver his inaugural address. And, you know, Arthur was sort of seen as this subversive character. So when Garfield is assassinated 4 months into office, people blame Arthur for it. And it's not helped by the fact that the assassin claims in a letter that he killed Garfield, expecting Arthur to become president so that he could be rewarded with consul general in Paris, which he claims Chester Arthur has promised him. And then it's made even worse by the fact that Chester Arthur had actually met with the assassin over patronage. So it's a bad look all around. It's Arthur spends the entire 80 days that James Garfield is on his deathbed desperately trying to get in to see the ailing president. And he says to somebody, I need to see him so I can clear my good name and so that he knows that I was not responsible for his assassination.
Wow. Yeah.
So imagine that. Imagine the gravity of that. And it's coupled and exacerbated by the fact that James Garfield is one of the most universally loved men in the history of the Republic.
Right, exactly. Theodore Roosevelt, you say that out of all these eight that we talk about, Theodore Roosevelt, although we call him an accidental president, he probably would have been president anyway at some point in his political career.
That's right. When McKinley, first of all, Roosevelt is the only person who's thrown onto the vice presidential ticket as a punishment. The New York party bosses just want to get rid of him, and they think they're exiling him to the political equivalent of Elba. When he's thrown onto the ticket in 1900, after the incumbent VP, Garrett Hobart, dies in office, Mark Hanna, who's one of McKinley's closest confidants, says to him, Mr. President, your primary responsibility is to survive the next 4 years so that maniac doesn't become president. And Hannah really sort of pioneers or coins the term heartbeat away from the presidency.
Yeah, right,
when
right.
McKinley dies in September of 1901, you know, Theodore Roosevelt can hardly contain his enthusiasm for the fact that he's about to become president. He has this great quote where he says, it's a terrible thing to come into the presidency this way, but it would be far worse to be morbid about it.
Calvin Coolidge.
So Calvin Coolidge becomes president following Warren Harding's death in office. The Harding administration is the most scandal-ridden administration in the history of the Republic. You have the Teapot Dome scandal, a big oil scandal, a massive scandal of the Veterans Bureau, and an attorney general and Justice Department complicit in everything from fight-fixing and stock manipulation to massive bootlegging operations. Calvin Coolidge is the only accidental president to inherit the presidency at the tail end of an administration with less than a year to go until the election of 1924. And Harding dies a very popular man, and Coolidge realizes all of these scandals are going to break on his watch just within months of the election. So he has a moment of self-reflection and realizes he's boring and a non-entity and not very well-known. So he doubles down on that identity and cultivates this image of, quote, Silent Cal, a man so boring and so insignificant that he couldn't possibly have been complicit in anything associated with Harding. So he basically throws the dead guy under the bus and sails to victory in 1924.
Now, Harry S. Truman, I mean, now he's succeeding one of the most beloved presidents ever, which is FDR, of course. But he really proved himself to be able to handle this role and an accomplished president, very well respected.
That's right. Truman is the most successful and unexpected of all the accidental presidents. In 1944, all the Democratic Party bosses know that FDR is a dying man, which is why they can't fathom the idea of the incumbent VP, Henry Wallace, staying on the ticket, because they view him as a Soviet sympathizer and far too liberal. So Truman is thrown on the ticket to get Wallace off the ticket. And in his 82 days as vice president, he's not briefed on the atomic bomb. He only meets FDR twice. He doesn't get a single intelligence briefing, never steps foot in the map room where the war is being planned, and doesn't meet a single foreign leader. Yet on April 12, 1945, he becomes the president while the Battle of Okinawa is raging, at a time when he has to contemplate moving a million men from the European theater to the Asian Pacific theater. 30 minutes after taking the oath of office, he's briefed on the atomic bomb, and he has to figure out what to do about this destructive weapon that may or may not work, and Stalin is reneging on all of his promises from Yalta. And yet in Truman's first 4 months, he makes some of the most important and seminal decisions that shaped the end of the war and the post-war order for decades to come. He's successful because men like Dean Acheson and George Marshall looked at Harry Truman and said, we miss FDR, and Truman is certainly no FDR, but the fate of the world rests on whether or not he's successful.
All right, we'll continue our conversation after the news next on 720 WGN.
America, sweet America, you know, God done shed his grace on thee.
Welcome back in. It's Dave Plyer for Steve Cochran this morning. We're talking to Jared Cohen, CEO of Jigsaw at Google parent company Alphabet, about his new book, Accidental Presidents, Eight Men Who Changed America. Now, in the book, I found it very fascinating about Lyndon Johnson, who is the most recent president that you call accidental. John F. Kennedy almost dropped him from the ticket.
That's right. And it's daunting writing about Lyndon Johnson because you think to yourself, what can I possibly say that Robert Caro hasn't already said? And that's the beautiful part about history, is there's still a lot to uncover. What I found in my interviews and research is that, so Lyndon Johnson was engulfed in this massive scandal involving one of his ex-Senate aides named Bobby Baker. You know, I believe that he was either going to have to resign as vice president or be thrown off the ticket the week following Kennedy's assassination for two reasons. One, both CBS and Time Life had the full dossier on the Bobby Baker affair, and they were prepared to go public with it the following week. And it would have been devastating for Johnson. Two, it became evident on that trip to Texas that LBJ didn't have the sway in Texas that he had in 1960. And that was very apparent to the Kennedy crowd. So the combination of those two things, I think, would have meant the end of LBJ. But when the Kennedy assassination happened, both CBS and Time Life made a deliberate decision to put the story back in the box. Remember, there's no provision for replacing the vice president at this stage. So you would have had a real dilemma where, you know, the accidental president, in this case, LBJ, would have been engulfed in such a public scandal just after the country had gone through a massive, dramatic, traumatizing assassination, which everybody was able to see after the fact on television, without vice president in line for the office. And the Constitution was very clear that if there's a vacancy in both the presidency and the vice presidency, at that stage, under the Presidential Succession Act of 1947, the Speaker of the House becomes an acting president until the Secretary of State can call a special election for the following November.
We're talking to Jared Cohen. His new book is Accidental Presidents, Eight Men Who Changed America. There were eight times in history where this happened, where the vice president took over for the president. But there were 19 times where it almost happened that you mentioned before, which only communicates, again, how critical the role of vice president is and who the president, potential president, chooses as a running mate.
That's correct. The combination of illness, accidents, and assassination attempts almost deprived us of 19 different presidents, including some who themselves ultimately died. I mean, Andrew Jackson was shot at point blank, but the gun malfunctioned, and then he beat the assailant with his cane, a man who thought he was the king of England. FDR, as president-elect, is giving a speech in Miami, and an Italian immigrant named Giuseppe Zangara fires five shots in 15 seconds at him. And thankfully, a 100-pound woman named Lillian Cross, standing next to the assassin, saw him pull a .32 caliber, moved her purse from one arm to another, and smacked his arm, thwarting his aim, and it killed four people, but not the president-elect. So in that instance, a woman and her purse saved the New Deal. And of course, President Kennedy, as president-elect, was nearly killed by a suicide bomber, a disgruntled postal worker who filled his pants with dynamite with his hand in his pocket on the trigger, ready to blow him up at church as he stood 4 feet away, but caught a glimpse of some children out of the corner of his eye. Of course, you know, Ford has two assassination attempts against him within 35 days. Reagan is shot. Mm-hmm. And then the number of presidents that nearly died of illness and office and accident is unending.
You mentioned people have mentioned that President Trump, and I've heard this before, well, he was kind of accidental, but it wasn't really accidental. He was unexpected, and he was kind of a dark horse. And at the end of the day, I'm not sure President Trump thought he would actually be in the White House. It's like James Garfield really didn't want any of the nominations either, but I think it was unexpected as much as it was unexpected for across America. It was unexpected for him as well.
That's right. You can't call President Trump an accidental president. Unexpected is correct. Dark horse is correct. But, you know, President Trump won the election. It's an electoral college system. And so it doesn't matter that he lost the popular vote. What matters is he got the 270 plus electoral votes. And that's how our system works. So there's nothing accidental about how he ended up as president. What I find interesting in reading this book is when I started writing this 5.5 years ago, President Trump hadn't even announced his candidacy. And I look at when the book came out, which is this current moment, and you have the oldest president in the history of the Republic.
Right.
We're in the longest period of time without the president dying in office, and the two leading contenders on the Democratic side are both in their 70s. If there was ever a time to think about the importance of the vice presidency and making sure that the only requirement that matters for that person is whether you can imagine them leading the country, it's the election of 2020.
We might think we are living in one of the most decisive political times in history, but it was really far worse back in the day.
I think that's the other thing that was interesting about writing this book is you would think writing a book about eight presidents who died in office and 19 who almost died, it would be a sort of sad and tragic story. But everybody ends up feeling kind of uplifted by the book because, you know, the stories cover a vast breadth of American history where we were far more polarized, where things were far nastier, corruption was rampant, hostility and assaults from the media were vitriolic. I mean, everything that we see today has some reference point in history that was much nastier. That shouldn't absolve us of responsibility to try to troubleshoot the very real problems that we're encountering today. But to me, a daunting challenge is when, if we look at what's happening today and say we've never seen that before, because when that happens, it means that you can't reflect back on and learn from history as we think about how to navigate through our current moment. And I don't think that we're seeing anything new. I think the tools are new, you know, the way it manifests itself is new, but you know, everything that we're experiencing in today's republic has its roots in some aspect of our history, including the transnational meddling.
Jared, you're also a collector of presidential memorabilia. Tell me like some of the highlights, because I know this is a very deep collectors group that really has some very unique things.
Yes, absolutely. So I've been collecting presidential memorabilia since my first bag of buttons from a flea market on Broadway and Grand Street when I was 8 years old.
Wow.
And I collect you know, presidential signatures, items owned by presidents. My favorite items, I just bought a Thomas Jefferson signed patent for a spring and a seatbelt. I have a painting painted by Dwight Eisenhower while he was president. I have Reagan's coffee mug, which I love drinking out of.
Wow.
But my prized possessions are my locks of presidential hair.
Which I didn't know that. I didn't know that was such a big... I have a friend of mine that collects presidential hair as well, believe it or not. I just find that hugely fascinating. Like, what's out there?
Well, I'm trying to make it hip again. I think that what I found with presidential hair collectors is we don't like going public because society rejects us. But what people don't realize is before the turn of the century into the 1900s, people didn't ask for autographs. They would write letters to presidents asking for a lock of their hair. So the president would snip a lock of their hair, attach it with wax to the paper, and send it to the, you know, the hair seeker. And the hair seeker, by the way, would get a lock of hair and an autograph.
Wow. Wow. Very fascinating. Fascinating. Hey, before we wrap things up, talk to our listeners just a little bit about what Jigsaw is all about, a unit within Alphabet, which is also the parent company of Google.
Yeah, of course. So Jigsaw looks at all the problems that are destabilizing the internet. So disinformation, state-sponsored cyber attacks, the spread of extremism online, the
censorship.
Trolling problem, you know, politically motivated censorship. And we're in the business at looking at all these, you know, problems that we're now familiar with today and asking what will they look like on a 1 to 2 year time horizon. So we subscribe to the view that we want to forecast where these problems are going. And then at the end of the day, we're an AI and engineering group. So we build and ship products against what we're projecting. So the way that we think about things is we apply a geopolitical lens to technology, and we're trying to build products that address some of the toughest geopolitical problems of our time, but we're trying to get ahead of these problems and anticipate what's next.
Talk about a little bit about your role as adjunct senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations.
Well, at the end of the day, I'm a foreign policy junkie. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, what I try to do with my affiliation with the Council on Foreign Relations is try to make sense of the current, you know, sort of disruptive world that we're living in right now, to try to make sense of how technology and geopolitics are clashing together. And the Council on Foreign Relations is one of those great foreign policy institutions where you have subject matter experts on, you know, everything from, you know, countries to issues to, you know, technology to the law. So it's a great intellectual sandbox to pursue those curiosities.
Yeah, very cool. Very cool. Well, we only scratched the surface of this new book, and there's just tons of great deep stories in this book. It's called Accidental Presidents. You pick it up from Amazon or wherever books are sold. Jared Cohen, pleasure speaking with you, and congratulations on the new book.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.